Yes, this is a sequel to the presentation I made last quarter, Jesus Takes on Babylon. And I simply compared and contrasted Jesus' sayings with some statements from Babylonian literature, particularly royal inscriptions and royal texts. I would like to begin with two things. You notice the word impart. There are many factors that led up to Jesus' death. There are Greco-Roman factors that led up to Jesus' death. And I don't want to say that I'm trying to cast the net too wide. I'm simply saying that there are also Babylonian things that Israel, or I should say Judaism, inherited from living in Babylon for so many years. And the thing that you should know as a kind of an underlying assumption that we're bringing to this is that the Jews living in Babylon into the first century influenced Judaism a lot more than we think they did. And the other thing you need to know, the other piece you need to know, is that Babylonians were still operating and still living in their place well into the Seleucid period, at least. I haven't been able to trace beyond that in terms of what I've read. But the influence is there. And so we're going to look at this. This is a work in progress. This is not a completed work, and this, therefore, is tentative as per further study and reading. It will be a gargantuan task to try to really do justice to this. And I didn't have time in a couple of weeks to pull it off to the extent that I would like. So let's begin. So it is my thesis, or maybe my underlying assumption, one that I have published somewhere, that Babylonia, together with ancient Sumer, formed the cradle of ancient and modern civilization through the two political nations they influenced, Greece and Rome. This is something that hasn't been dealt with as much as it should be. There have been a few Assyriologists who have made stabs at this direction in showing how Babylonian thought and institutions and all of that influenced Greece and Rome, and thus Christian Rome, or Roman Christianity, I should say. Mesopotamia spawned myths related to, but earlier than, the Hebrew Bible. Its people composed the earliest written legal sources of the ancient world, and they developed a city whose assembly helped to administer affairs. I have unpacked this many years ago when I first uncovered it. I presented it to this class. Some of you may not have been here at that time, so we will go through it again. The three great institutions that I see Babylonia giving to Western civilization are economics, kingship, and judicial systems. Now, of course, we don't have kingship, but hierarchy really is what they gave the world. And I tagged some things under these that show the trajectory of these three institutions are really very self-centered, self-interest. And particularly if you go back to their beginnings, economics really gave us self-interest. It really came out of self-interest. Spawned in debt, dependency and indebtedness, and of course gave rise to competition. The idea of substitution is rooted in economics, and it plays a major role in all of Babylonian thinking and all of the things that they engage in, whether it's religion or politics or legal systems. Slavery is a product of economics. Stratification of society, which we know has reached a new height in Hammurabi. When Hammurabi was king, he developed the class system of Babylon.
Jean, what do you mean by substitution?
Substitution, well, let me give you some examples. We're going to talk about this later. The
I don't want to hold you up.
The substitute king ritual, for example, in medicine, they would take a figurine and they would manipulate things with it, and then they would take it and they would touch a patient body part to body part with that figurine, and then they would discard the figurine in some way, give it to the dogs to chew apart or throw it away or whatever. And that the term for that substitute, and it was substitute, the term for that is a legal term. So legally, they took off the disease of the person, and then they discarded that figurine so that the person could be healed. It was both penalty, it was both substitutionary. That's just an example. So that's what I mean by substitution, of course, in economics, is exchange. I exchange one item for another. Kingship. One person has the God-ordained right, and I need to emphasize God-ordained, because in Mesopotamia, kingship came down from heaven. It was the God-ordained right to rule all others. Whoever has the most power is most important, and rights to punish and control subjects through fear, and will come back to angry kings needing to be appeased. And judicial systems became a way to control items of self-interest. The earliest legal systems were in the interest of conserving property. They were property issues. Externally imposed penalties support the system of order. An early law was not about commands, but about settlements. And we'll come back to that when we come to this discussion. Now, I need to enter you into a little bit of a debate. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but this is a debate that Near Eastern scholars have among themselves. That is, I should say, legal experts in the ancient Near East have among themselves about ancient Near Eastern law. I first encountered this at the University of California. The Bolt School of Law invited ancient Near Eastern scholars to come together kind of in a closed group, not open to other people, to talk about issues that pertain to their debate. And so they brought the big names to the campus. And my Akkadian professor found out about it and told me, and I said, I want to go. Because my major in my doctoral program was ancient Near Eastern and biblical law. So she finagled me to be able to go with the Bolt School of Law, but not with the big name scholars. And consequently, one of them named Martha Roth from the University of Chicago got really angry and called up my professor and had it out with her. But I still got to go. And it saved me hours of reading to try to get to the bottom of where the discussion was, because they really went at each other. The fast and furious and feuding and fighting. And so on. So there's one camp of scholars who suggest that laws are not really laws. Laws of Hammurabi, laws of Eshnunna, Neo-Babylonian laws, Middle Assyrian laws, those are not laws. They're simply exercises copied by students in scribal schools. Something like textbooks. Measly textbooks. I mean, how many scholars would ever cite a textbook, or how many experts would ever cite a textbook? So that's just all they are. The laws of Hammurabi were simply royal propaganda intended to impress the gods that Hammurabi was truly a just king. And there's some reason for that. Those laws were stationed in the temple before Marduk. So there does seem to be this element of propaganda. However, there is a statement in his prologue to the effect that he hopes the commoner will come and read his laws and find justice. These and other laws share points of commonality, the most famous of which is the law of the goring ox, found in various ways in laws of Hammurabi, the laws of Eshnunna, and the covenantal code. There is no term for law. And this is true. There is no term for law in either Sumerian or Akkadian, which means that whatever had to do with law was judiciary. That's why I stated the third system was not law. It was judicial practice. So on the other side of things, if it's true that they were just school texts, why were the students studying them? And the truth is that many of the scribes who went to school, they didn't just go out and put up their shingle and say, I'm now a scribe, please hire me. They worked for the royal court, the royal legal court. And they did scribal work for the royal court. If they didn't do scribal work for the royal court, they went to work for local courts. And if they didn't work for local courts, they went to work for temple courts. And yes, some of them probably did other things with their scribal skills. But it was important for them to work through these laws to gain an understanding of the vocabulary, how to write legal text, and so on. So on the other side of things, Westbrook is the one most known for suggesting that laws represent a significant stream of judicial scholarship. And because of the similarities between the laws of Eshnunna and the laws of Hammurabi, composed in roughly the same time period, it seems they were not anomalous within the general legal milieu of Babylonia. The problem for scholars is that when they study the court cases, they don't see reflections of those important laws. That's the problem. Keep in mind that the scribal schools produce future legal experts, royal officers involved, and I've already stated that. Let's move on. Now, it is true, and Westbrook himself admits this, Mesopotamian law is not like modern law. We get modern law through the Greco-Roman system of law, not through ancient Near Eastern law. Our modern concept of law is built upon legal developments in Greece and Rome, where written laws became reference points for citation according to the law, and where specific wording was debated. And this actually has precedence, not in ancient Near Eastern law, per se, or Mesopotamian law, maybe I should say more specifically, but in biblical law. Jeremiah the prophet references the biblical laws in one of his discourses. Ancient Near Eastern law is not like Greco-Roman law. Instead of citing laws, legal scribes would create objective cases, extending them to include possible scenarios using analogy. I call this expansionism. So you have a case of a goring ox. So you write that case. If an ox gores an ox and its owner is not aware that there's been a gorer before, he is merely fined and he is told to keep the ox in. But suppose that the ox has no one to gore. The owner knows this and he hasn't kept him in. Well, then you need a stiffer penalty. And depending on the repercussions of the goring ox, if he gored another ox or if he gored a human, and if the human died, all of those things are ramifications, so you need laws to cover all of them. And that's kind of how Babylonian law worked. So edicts, commandments, and decrees probably played a minor role in the courts, though they play a major role in the Hebrew Bible. Some believe that the Bible was the first to use law in the modern sense and cite the covenantal code. Westbrook suggests that this first occurs during the prophets and dates the legal narratives later than most mainstream biblical scholars do, liken it to Greek and narrative law. In a mainstream biblical scholarship, that's heresy because they have evidence internally in the documents themselves that they have to be earlier, if you take the whole. But what I contend is that both Finkelstein and Westbrook ignore one of the facets of Hebrew law that explains one of its important genres, the covenant. Where you have a treaty, you have stipulations. And all the laws of the Old Testament are seen as parts of the treaty, as stipulations of the treaty between God and Israel. We call it the covenant. The Bible calls it the covenant. And this is a valid legal form of ancient Near Eastern royal law that requires the vassal to keep the terms of the suzerain. And furthermore, ascribing laws to a heroic figure is not merely Hellenistic, as Westbrook suggests. Neo-Babylonian scribes copied the laws of Hammurabi, and Nebuchadnezzar appears to have attempted to emulate this famous Amorite king of Babylon. Let me unpack that a little bit. Neo-Babylonia is the Babylonian period of the exile. And Nebuchadnezzar, it's possible that Nebuchadnezzar had his scribes copy Hammurabi's laws, but at least we know they were being copied. And it seems And by the way, Wiseman wasn't the first to suggest this. The eminent Lambert from Britain suggested it first, that he seems to have tried to become the second Hammurabi. So, what about Moses? Couldn't he serve as another Hammurabi? And in fact, David Wright has shown that the Book of the Covenant, and let me explain what the Book of the Covenant is. It is Exodus, roughly Exodus, the last little piece of Exodus 20 through Exodus 23. That's the Book of the Covenant. David Wright has shown that the Book of the Covenant actually follows the subjects of the laws of Hammurabi in content. And I would like to point out something I think I failed to put on here. Maybe we'll come to it. Instead of calling, there was a shift that was made sometime in either Israel or Judaism. It isn't clear to me yet. I haven't studied this enough to know where that shift took place. But there was a shift that took place from calling the laws of Yahweh, to calling them the laws of Moses. So unique features of biblical law. Nowhere else in the ancient Near East, except possibly theocratic Egypt, where Israel, where Pharaoh is deified, does deity promulgate law. And nowhere else in the entire ancient Near East does deity formulate a suzerain vassal treaty with a nation. You just don't find that. Most of the divinely given stipulations are apodictic. Let me explain apodictic law. Well, in order to explain apodictic law, I need to explain casuistic law. Casuistic law is built on cases, actual cases. They have a protasis, if a man does such and such, and then a potasis, then you shall do such and such. These are primarily penalty laws. They are laws that are established in order to suggest what the penalty should be for a specific crime. And does the Bible have them? Absolutely. Laws of the Book of the Covenant are mostly case laws, casuistic laws. Apodictic law, on the other hand, is what you find in the Ten Commandments. You shall not kill, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not steal. No penalty attached in the law. Just you shall not. Those are edicts, sometimes called statutes. And they're just statements of what you should or should not do. Until the time of the monarchy, most laws were handled by the priest through town elders decided court though town elders decided court cases at the city gate. Well, this is not so unique. What is unique is the fact that during this period, Israel had no king. The most significant difference is that Yahweh required Israel to keep his laws, and this I have to highlight this. The laws of Hammurabi, you weren't required to keep. They were for the judges. They were for the people to understand how justice worked. There were no laws that people had to keep except oral laws. Oral laws, understood law, was what you were to keep and society. And if you broke understood law, then you could be taken to court. And this is going to figure prominently when we come to the Pharisees. So how did law function in Israel? Most of the terms for law in Hebrew derived from the judicial setting, the court judges, just like in Mesopotamia. Though ascribed to Yahweh, most of the casuistic laws in the Hebrew Bible came from the same context. But in many ways, law functioned as teaching. Torah means teaching. In Deuteronomy 4, 5, Moses states that he taught Israel the laws. In verse 6, they are to be your wisdom and understanding. This is teaching kinds of vocabulary. And the people were to pass them on to their children. Many of the laws contain motive clauses that, unlike their counterparts in cuneiform law, motivate their adherence by reference to a historic event, promise of well-being, or a divine will. Right in the Ten Commandments, you have a motive clause. Honor your father and your mother that your days may be long upon the land which the Lord your God gives you. Or the laws in Deuteronomy pertaining to how you treat slaves. You are to treat slaves this way. Because you remember that in Egypt you were slaves, and God brought you out with a mighty hand. Now we come to how this affects Judaism, how this processes. A shift takes place in the Second Temple period. This is now post-exilic. As legal instruction with covenantal obedience required. If you look at Deuteronomy, the Septuagint, the emphasis is on teaching. And the Septuagint is there fairly late. But somewhere along that line, teaching became really much more obedience-driven in a formal sense. And so, though you don't lose the covenant and teaching aspect, that bond of trust that undergirded all covenant law seemed to get less left behind and left in the dust. Originally, cases were tried at the city gate by the elders who acted as judges. Harder cases referred to specific judges as Deborah or Gideon, or to the priests. This continued after the monarchy allowed the king to be chief judge of difficult cases. In the post-exilic period, judgment seems to have shifted from the elders at the city gate to the priests at the temple. From law as part of narrative, which gave it situational context and explanation, law became structured as codes with the rise of the Holocaust, later called the Mishnah. In later Talmudic law, the kinds of motive clauses found in Torah gave way to explanations for expansionism. And I'm going to give you some examples in a moment. Let me talk a little bit about the Talmud so you understand what I mean by Talmud. The Talmud came to be comprised of the Mishnah, which originally were the oral laws called the Halakot. Halakha means walking in the way. And so the Halakot, when they came to be written down, became the Mishnah. The Mishnah became part of the Talmud. The Talmud is in two kinds, the Babylonian Talmud and the Palestinian Talmud or the Jerusalem Talmud. The Babylonian Talmud is called because it comes down from Babylon. And it was the most prominent and the most used part of the Talmud in Jerusalem. And of course, in Jesus' day, all this was still oral. This had not been written down. This was not written down until after the last time that Jerusalem was destroyed in, I believe it was 135. So in Jesus' day, these were still oral. And remember, in ancient Mesopotamian law, you understood law. Your oral laws were the ones you kept. So I'm going to skip the next part because it's a minor detail. In pre-exilic times, God delivered Israel and gave his laws through Moses. In the Second Temple period, the law was given by Moses, perhaps viewed similarly to Hammurabi. Recall the disputes of the scribes with Jesus over what Moses wrote in the law, and Jesus' contention that they didn't really believe Moses. Moses was always the figure that they disputed.
Gene, let me interrupt here. Maybe I'm the only one that doesn't remember. When was the exile?
The exile is 538, starting 538 B.C. So you're talking several centuries before Christ. And one of the things I need to unpack before we go on is I read a very fascinating article by Alice Rivkin, a Jewish scholar, who contends, and he seems to have evidence to support it, that the scribes and Pharisees that you see in the Gospels are not scribes and Pharisees, they are scribes, even Pharisees. The Pharisees was a term the Sadducees gave the scribes. The scribes is what they call themselves. So now you learn something new. So did I. The Babylonian Talmud began as oral tradition during the exile or post-exilic periods. And I've already unpacked that. So here we have some examples from the Mishnah. Now, the Babylonian Talmud is comprised of the Mishnah and the Gemara. The Gemara is the unpacking of the Mishnah, so it's the rabbinic discussion about the Mishnah, and it resembles a little more of Greco-Roman law as opposed to the Mishnah, which is expansionist like the Babylonian law. So here's an example regulations for women's apparel on Sabbath. I thought you women would enjoy this. What ornamental apparel may a woman go out in, and what she may not go out, not in woolen or linen bands or with straps on her head, lest she take off the bands to show her friends, thereby by becoming guilty of carrying movable property for a distance of 4 ells or more, nor to bathe herself with bands unless loosened, nor is she to go out with either whatever those are, unless they are fastened, nor with a hood in public ground, nor with gold ornaments, nor with nose rings, nor with finger rings that have no seal, nor with pins. But if she does do this, she is not to bring a sin offering, because they are ornaments and not burdens. Here's another example. The ass is not to go out with a rug unless fastened with the cords tied to them, neither with a bell that has been muffled, nor with a collar on its neck, nor with ankle boots. The hens are not to go out with cords tied to them. It seems like you'd be very busy on Friday if all your animals had these things and you had to take them all off before Sunday. The hens are not to go out with cords tied to them or straps on their feet. Rams are not to go out with reed yoke, nor the cows with the skin and hedgehog tied to the udder, nor with strap between her horns. And so then Mishnah 5, a woman may go out with plaits of hair, be they made of her own hair of another woman or of an animal, with whatever those things are, with a hood or with a wig in her yard, and with cotton wadding. And this gives just a long, long list of things that she can go out with, but I thought you should particularly note this. As for metal or golden tooth, Rabbi permits a woman to go out with it, but the sages prohibit it. So if you have a gold tooth in your mouth, too bad. Don't wear it on Sabbath.
This was oral law?
This was oral.
So you had to know all this just from memory?
Well, in oral society, oral memory is very good. You know, whereas today we're more visual society and we don't remember anything we hear. So during the old Babylonian period, the chief purpose of holding a trial or dealing with a court case was to create reconciliation between two estranged parties. During the Neo-Babylonian period, though, settlement could take place in the pre-trial phase, the purpose of the actual trial was to establish a verdict and administer whatever penalty was chosen by the judges. This is a real switch. If you read law court cases from the old Babylonian period, there's a clause at the very end that after the decision of the judges is registered, so-and-so and so-and-so, the two parties, agreed with that decision. So there's discussion and attempt to bring reconciliation. You have to assume that because laws or court cases don't tell you more than just the minimum. And so there's that discussion going on. You don't find that except maybe in the pre-trial part of law court cases in the Neo-Babylonian period. So you can see the old B kind of trial at work in Israel's pre-monarchical period and so on. By the time of the first century CE Judaism, the Sanhedrin reflected more the style developed in the Neo-Babylonian period. Keep in mind, the influence of Jews living in Babylonia was quite strong in Jerusalem's legal matters. The Sanhedrin. In Babylonia, several court systems held trials. The chief over these, the royal court, dealt with the most of the civil cases. However, local assemblies, I'm talking about Babylonia now, also existed for the purpose of holding court. Finally, temple judges presided over cases pertaining to the temple. For emerging Judaism during the exile, here they were, they no longer have a king, they have no self-governing, they're forced to seek identity, they don't have a temple anymore. And so they're forced to seek identity chiefly in Torah and religion. Having such an assembly to deal with legal disputes among themselves must have seemed a necessity. And of course, the Sanhedrin in the New Testament reflects the Roman period where we know the most about it, yet such an assembly under varying names and differing functions must go far back into the exilic period. The Pharisees and the Sadducees. In the Neo-Babylonian period, the role of the scribe who served in the courts changed from that of a writer to a writer who was also involved in judicial affairs, even operating at times as a judge. We have this actually documented in the text, the court cases and letters. What this suggests is that the scribes, that is the Pharisees, were actually, had transformed their identity from writers to legal experts. And legal experts are the... Legal experts are the term that the Common English Bible now uses for the scribes. Call them legal experts. And I think that's appropriate. So the Sadducees disapproved of how the Pharisees held to oral laws that became known as the Mishnah, and ultimately, together with the Gemara, formed the Talmud. The Sadducees held only to Torah, rejected the Pharisees' views on the judgment and afterlife. In Matthew 23, Jesus singles out the Pharisees for castigation, but nowhere does he focus on the Sadducees except when correcting them regarding the resurrection, which is kind of interesting. The Pharisees could be viewed as the theologians, though legal experts is probably more appropriate, whereas prominently the priests were the Sadducees. In their high regard for Torah, this, remember the bone of contention, they have Torah, Pharisees have oral law. The Sadducees loved the lex talionis that stemmed from Hammurabi's laws. They applied it so mercilessly that the people preferred the Pharisees to the Sadducees despite their many laws for their merciful treatment. So you had these two options in Judaism. You could either go with the Pharisees with all their many laws but their merciful treatment, or you could skip those oral laws and just stick with Torah, but you had all this harsh treatment for the Sadducees. When Jesus countered talionic law in Matthew 5:38-42, when he refused to have the woman caught in adultery stoned, and when he allowed the woman with the hemorrhage to touch his garment, and when he touched the lepers, he stood in opposition to the Sadducees. Jesus acted against the Sadducees. He spoke against the Pharisees. When his disciples did not wash properly or ate grain, they picked while walking through a grain field on Sabbath. Jesus challenged the traditions and laws of the Pharisees. So he did act against them too. He was harder on the Pharisees than he was on the Sadducees. Where Jesus clashed most vigorously with the Pharisees had to do with Sabbath keeping. Jesus repeatedly broke the oral laws for keeping Shabbat and other laws too. None of his Sabbath healings were emergency cases. He told the paralytic to carry his mat, which required him to roll it. You can guess what law that might have broken. I haven't gotten through the Talmud. So I can't tell you exactly where these are in the Talmud. He called the woman with scoliosis to the male section of the synagogue, up to the front. She was not supposed to ever be there. Terrible. And he laid hands on her, even, and healed her. Radical. He healed a man with a withered hand. He healed a man born blind. This is one of my favorite healings. By the following. He spit on the ground, potentially watering on the Sabbath. He formed mud with his hand, potentially making pottery. He anointed the man's eyes. Oral law forbade medical treating of the face. Anything above the neck was not to be treated on the Sabbath day or to be washed. Couldn't wash your face on Sabbath. He sent him to the pool of Siloam, maybe more than a Sabbath day's journey. If the man was near the temple, the pool of Siloam was about a Sabbath day's journey across Jerusalem, and Jesus told him to come back, so he went double. He had him wash the mud off, and law forbade washing above the neck. And then the last one I just think is really neat. The Pool of Siloam was the Jewish baptismal font for proselytes, and so Jesus had him desecrate holy water. Okay. I see Jesus as deliberately dealing with Pharisaic law. While Torah and the prophets forbade working on Sabbath, little is specified regarding what is work. Oral tradition, however, had over 400 laws specifying minutely what one could and could not do on the Sabbath. And examples include, I'm going to point only to this one because of lack of time, they are forbidden to write two single letters or characters or erasing in order to write two letters. That's like Aleph, Beit. Can't write that on the Sabbath. And then, of course, you couldn't you couldn't carry a mouthful of milk, enough honey to cover a wound, enough water for an eye bath. Prescribed quantities for all other liquids was 1 quart. Don't ask me how that makes sense. Now, here's the interesting thing. Babylonia had many important, and I don't know whether you would call them holy days, but they were certainly had religious overtones. These evil days, the evil days consisted of the 7th, 14th, 19th, 21st, and 28th of the lunar month. These are lunar days, not weekly days. And these were days on which certain activities were not propitious to do. You could anger the gods if you did these. There also existed the Shapatu, the 15th day of the lunar month, which was and is the day when the sun and the moon stand in opposition to each other. From a religious standpoint, Shamash, the god of daytime justice, and Sin, the god of nighttime justice, stood in opposition to each other. This day was referred to as the day of the resting of the heart, that is the day of appeasement. Now, Shapatu sounds a lot like Shabbat. So the question needs to be raised whether the scribal keeping of Shabbat rather better reflected Torah or the Babylonian special days. The priesthood. In early Sumer, a kind of priest-king both ruled the city-state and prescribed over the temple. Whether ruler or priest, he bore the title En, meaning ruler or lord. Though later abandoned, this concept of ruling priests is thus very ancient. Similarly, the Jewish priests came to govern the cult, religion, and even to some extent national affairs, though limited, of course, by foreign powers over them. By the Neo-Babylonian period, the administration of the En priests and priestesses had long since given away to the power of the male and the Shangu, power of the male-only Shangu, the administrative and cultic high priest. During this period, the temple priesthood was quite hierarchical in structure, and the priests acted harshly toward the foreign female slaves and often sexually exploited them. They did so much so a lot of these slaves ran away, which is it's a terrible risk to try to run away when you're a slave. In Babylonia, if you get caught running away, you could expect very harsh treatment. Coming back. In Jewish law, that is Torah, a runaway slave was to be harbored and protected. Similarly, the Jewish priests had a hierarchical structure above which the high priest had considerable power. They were mostly Sadducees who ruled the people harshly, even though it was the Pharisees who brought the adulterous woman to Jesus for stoning. The Sadducees, no doubt, supported this event. And then we have some hints of temple economy. Just as the temple served as a substantially economic institution in ancient Mesopotamia, so the Jerusalem temple was the chief economic center of Judaism. And just as the Babylonians brought their offerings to the temple so the priests could feed the gods and thus procure divine favor, so the Jewish people brought their offerings to achieve divine forgiveness. And you remember that Jesus cleansed the temple of this economic riffraff. Just as Babylonians viewed wealth and prosperity as signs of divine favor, so Judaism perpetuated this view. And Jesus' suggestion to the rich young ruler to sell all that he had and give to the poor and then follow him was a counterintuitive message to ancient ears. The anointed was a term applied in the pre-exilic Israel to the king. In the second temple period, it referred to the Messiah who would eventually restore the throne of David and rule in Jerusalem. Kingship, of course, came from ancient Mesopotamia, where it progressed from a simple ruler or governor to a bureaucratic king who ruled by conquest and hierarchical power over his subjects. When Jesus asserted his messiahship, he drastically reduced his kingship to teaching, healing, and reforming temple practices. He redefined covenant and law and asserted no dictatorial or judicial power over others except when exercising mercy toward sinners, as in the case of the adulterous woman. When Jesus rode on a donkey to Jerusalem, he borrowed a motif from the Greco-Roman times when a ruler or conqueror would ride into the city after conquest. I preached a sermon on this, you may remember, a couple of years ago. But we know from the Syrian reliefs that a very similar entrance took place in Neo-Assyrian and likely Neo-Babylonian periods. One cannot think of the comparison of Nebuchadnezzar marching into Babylon toward the temple of Marduk, whose planet was Jupiter, and the early Roman conquerors whose face was painted red like Jupiter's statue. Typically, the procession would end at halt at the temple where in Rome a sacrifice of white oxen would be made, and that recalls something from Babylon. The entourage of the conqueror included his army, spoils, captives, and sacrificial animals. Jesus' triumphal entry turns this motif upside down. He himself, the king and conqueror, is the sacrifice about to be made. His army consists of his disciples who battle evil principalities and powers without use of force. His captives are those he sets free from disease, death, and tyranny of religious bigotry. He comes into the temple. In Mark, he merely looks around and leaves. In Matthew, he cleanses it from all that is economic in nature. And then he heals the blind and the lame while the children kept crying out, "Hosanna to the Son of David." Now we come to the basis of Jesus' death. Caiaphas argued that the reason for Jesus' death was that it is expedient for you that one man should die for the people and that the whole nation should not perish. Alexander the Great was struck by the substitute king ritual, apparently done by the Babylonians still in the tradition of the Neo-Assyrian period. In this ritual, when the omen signified the gods were angry with the king and would destroy him, the king would leave the throne and a substitute king would be installed who would rule for some days. At the end of those days, a banquet would be held and the substitute king and his wife would be taken out and executed. Then the real king would return to his throne and rule. This substitute king ritual is, well, maybe I should put it this way, Caiaphas' words, hauntingly similar to this ritual. The usual ancient Near Eastern purpose for offering human sacrifice was to appease divine anger. The concept of angry gods needing appeasement is a prominent belief, at least in Mesopotamia, seems to derive from human experiences with angry kings. In the Syrian dictionary, the references to angry gods occur more numerously where the most references to angry kings exist. You can just sit there with those Syrian dictionaries. I mean, there's multiple words for anger. Okay, so you look them all up, and wherever you find angry kings, you find angry gods. In Babylonian correspondence with angry Assyrian kings, the reference is made to the wrath of God and king. They're in the same clause. A parallel exists in the Hebrew Bible where an emphasis of divine anger occurs mostly during times of power, such as the monarchical period. Jesus rarely got angry, and when he did, his anger could be described as grief, according to Mark 3:5. Jesus never portrayed his father as angry. Now, Jesus' trial and crucifixion. All I'm saying here is that the focus of that trial was to obtain a verdict or of a capital crime, not to achieve reconciliation. The Sanhedrin were not interested in reconciliation with Jesus. Crucifixion probably came from the Persians originally, who reportedly put to death 3,000 Babylonians by this means. But the forerunner of crucifixion is probably the act of impalement, which was known to the Babylonians and to the Assyrians. When John cites an angel saying, "Babylon has fallen," in Revelation, to what is he referring? Babylon here is the antithesis of the New Jerusalem, what in John's day is the most natural antithesis of the New Jerusalem. Can prophecy, especially apocalyptic prophecy, have more than one relevant application? And I point you here to, "And the woman that you saw as the great city has dominion over the kings of the earth." That suggests something big. And so one application that John might be making might not include that. And then the line, "The wine of the wrath for fornication," goes to the line, "And the kings of the earth have committed fornication with her." What is the significance of these lines? And why would John use Babylon to refer to Rome or to old Jerusalem? I'm ready for discussion. I know we don't have much time, I know, but...
Same time, I can just answer all those questions.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking that John is thinking Old Jerusalem as Babylon. But his description is bigger than Old Jerusalem. And so this is why I'm interested in multiple applications at different time periods. And so I see that as the most natural antithesis of New Jerusalem. And that is the position of many scholars about Babylon and what it is. Then can prophecy have more than one relevant application? I believe it can. And then the wine of the wrath of her fornication goes with the lines, and the king of the earth have committed fornication with her. The idea of angry God and angry king, I think, ultimately gives rise, is one of the, at least one of the ideological streams into which gives the union of religion and state. See, Babylon rides the beast, right? And there's no question that the beast is Rome, I think, in Revelation, according to John. I'm looking at it through John's eyes. So I'm giving it a local application for now. Babylon rides the beast. And it's interesting that the early pioneers, when they looked at Revelation, they saw the fornication with kings as the union of church and state. We've lost that somewhere in all of our arguing. And then, why would John use Babylon to refer to Rome or Old Jerusalem? I have trouble with Babylon being Rome because the beast is Rome. And why would you have Babylon separate from the beast but riding the beast be Rome? And so Old Jerusalem. And of course, if you go into the way Adventists currently interpret these, it has a broader application. But I see these as kind of typologies that can be reduplicated by others. Yeah.
When I look at when John cites an angel saying Babylon has fallen, I think of Babylon in quite a few ways. One being confusion, and also not only confusion, but confusion usually comes from, not what it usually comes from, confusion comes from that false religion, that false faith, which originates back to Satan, who wants to come up with a counterfeit.
Well, you would need to have seen the other side of this when I talked about Jesus takes on Babylon.
Mm-hmm.
Those three institutions that I talk about at the beginning, that the economics, kingship, and judicial systems, to me, those are the epitome of what the false gods become. All false worship ties in with those three kinds of ideologies. Yeah.
Building on what you were talking about before, it really kind of dramatizes the reality that Jesus was trying to show them something really different than what they had been doing, and the Bible writers recording this were really trying to make that evident in what they wrote, that Jesus was doing something really different than what the stuff had been based on.
We don't have the background of behind all that Jesus does, and so we miss all of the cues and all of the things that make Jesus so radical. And of course, if you highlight the Greco-Roman scene behind Jesus, it even magnifies that a lot
really
more.
He was really radical. I mentioned to Brian as you were going through this, no wonder they were so upset with him.
Yeah. Yeah, Alicia.
I wasn't here for y'all's presentation, but hearing those three different things and hearing about his radical social movement and really what's happening, it's still so relevant in terms of what systems are perpetuating injustice and what systems are creating pain and suffering in our society, and how can we continue to live this radical life in which we're continuously using Jesus as an example.
In today's world, when you get put in prison for feeding the homeless, for example, you know, it becomes very, very radical.
Yeah. and relevant. Violence. Like,
right.
It's so easy to go with, to fight anger with anger, and that's really a beautiful message.
Yeah, that's the current theme that I see on I Support the Ordination of Women Facebook group. Is this, where do we go? Are we going to fight women's ordination with the same kind of venom that the opposition is fighting it, or are we going to try a different route? And thankfully, they're coming around to a little different, better way of doing this, I hope. So, okay, let's bow our heads. Closing prayer. Father, we ask that whatever we do with Babylon, with Revelation, that we not repeat the Babylonian models in our lives. We ask that we will model the way Jesus treated people, the way he dealt with Sabbath, the way he dealt with women, the way he dealt with the breakers of the law. We ask that we may live his life and be his hands and feet. And we thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.